Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Wave after wave of food-related bad news has thrown an uncomfortable light on the world's industrial food chain lately. Mad cow, salmon laced with PCBs, chickens with the flu. It's enough to make you go vegetarian if you weren't worried about tomatoes with flounder genes or GM corn. Now, one man, Todd Murphy, is planting a seed that might grow in a different direction. He's dreaming of a national chain of affordable restaurants where the menu is loaded with food that's organic and local. He started with one diner in Vermont that just might be the seed of a revolution. Tonight on Point, the Farmer's Diner and one man's answer to factory farming. Have you had it with Frankenfood, with industrial, long-distance, processed meat, vegetables, and milk? Is there a market niche for a national restaurant franchise that serves locally grown food? Would you pull over for a homegrown meal? Or are you hooked on Chilean grapes, strawberries from Ecuador, and 75-cent hamburgers? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Norwich, Vermont, is Todd Murphy, owner of the Farmer's Diner in Barrie, Vermont. Good evening and welcome, Todd Murphy.
Good evening, Tom.
It's great to have you with us. Thanks for joining us tonight.
Oh, you're welcome.
Todd, we know you've got a big vision here and a big picture, but give us the local one first. Describe your first place there, the Farmer's Diner in Barrie, Vermont. What does it look like? What does it do? Where does the food come from?
Well, it's an old restaurant. It's been there for about 70 years. It started off with what locals called the Gypsy Wagon, which was an old horse-drawn wagon. And then added on to that was a typical 1940s-style diner car, a Worcester car or Sioux City-type dining car. So we have now about 60 seats. We took that over a year and a half ago in July of 2002. It had been out of business for about a year, and we renovated it as best we could and just started bringing in whatever we could find local.
And what does the menu look like, Todd?
Well, it's I always joke with people who ask about the menu. I say if we got 100 people in a room and asked them to write out what a diner menu would be, we'd agree with about 80% of it, and that's where we are. Hamburgers, breakfast all day, eggs, hash, pancakes, things of that nature.
So if the menu looks familiar, what makes the restaurant different?
What makes it different is that we are purchasing a huge quantity of food within 60 miles of the restaurant. We have found farmers and small-scale food producers within that 60 to 80-mile radius of the diner that we are buying directly from. We spend about 70 cents of every dollar that we spend on food, we spend in that tight geographic circle.
How does that compare with what a normal, ordinary diner would do?
Well, from what I hear of normal, ordinary diners in my travels, mostly they buy from one of the big food providers, U.S. Foods or Sysco, and call in an order to that kind of an outfit. Or in the case of a Friendly's or a chain restaurant like that, they would call the corporate distribution point and get one delivery, one truckload, however many times a week they need it.
So normally, the big semi-trailer trucks we see with food, painting of food all over the side, they're delivering the food to restaurants and diners. In your case, how does the food come to you, and exactly where does it come from? Okay, it's within a 60 to 80-mile radius. What does that mean? Who's providing your beef, your buns, your vegetables, your milk?
Well, that's a long answer. Most of our farmers are what would be considered small family farmers, what listeners would consider a family farm. Farms that maybe are doing $100,000 a year in sales if they're really lucky. Here in Vermont, the geography is such that the farms are anywhere from 100 to 50 acres to 20 acres, depending on what they're growing for us. Mostly independent people who decided to come back and try farming from other careers or who grew up as farmers and went off to school and decided this was really the life that they wanted to lead.
So you're getting – give us some examples of what you're getting from them. What kind of farmers are providing what produce?
Sure. Our dairy, which is organic, and that includes milk and butter and ice cream, comes from Earl and Amy Ransom, the name of their farmers, the Stratford Organic Creamery. Earl and Amy moved back to the farm about 6 years ago, and Earl's two brothers are also involved in the operation. One grows chickens for eggs, and the other helps out on the farm. So they provide us with a lot of dairy. They also, during the growing season, are part of our supply chain. They bring vegetables to us from a farm that's about 15 miles down the road from them. That's Will and Kate's farm. They are right on the shores of the Connecticut River. It's a 50-acre vegetable operation. Primarily strawberries is their big crop, but they also do tomatoes and onions and vegetables like that that we have both fresh in the diner, and this year, very exciting for us, we turned a lot of their end-of-the-season produce into salsa that we'll be using throughout the winter.
So there's a couple of examples. So what's the sell here, or the attraction, Todd? Why should a diner come to the farmer's diner? Why should a hungry seeker for lunch come to your doorstep?
Well, Tom, our model has always been to try to find locations that were good diner locations. And this old diner had been there for 70 years. It's right on Main Street in a town of about 7,000 people. And so a lot of people came when we first opened because we were open and we were in a good location. And that's really what we had hoped for. And then there were folks who heard about us, the folks that we call the true believers, people who are very educated about food and understand the consequences of being disconnected from food, such as you outlined at the opening, who found us, and they come because for them it's a destination. Once the people who are coming just because we're in a good location come in, there's a lot of storytelling that we do in the diner on placemats, magazines that we have about the place, books and so forth that really reinforce the story of what we're trying to do. That they focus on the farmers. They tell the story of a tomato, what a local tomato means to the local economy, and really kind of a tangible example of things that we hear about when a dollar spent locally gets translated around seven times in the community. Well, we just kind of lay that out. How does that happen with a local tomato? And people are excited about that.
And there you're talking about an economic argument for eating here because the farmers
sure.
will pump money into the local economy. What about the dining experience? I mean, what's the difference if the tomato comes from 60 miles away or 600 miles away or, I don't know, take us through some other foods that you might be talking about. Is there a difference that people can perceive when they sit down and the plate of food comes at the farmer's diner?
Well, I'm very surprised at that because there's a huge difference that customers reiterate to me. They say that the taste is the biggest thing that they notice as a difference right off the bat. In fact, when we have to go from local fresh tomatoes back to commercial tomatoes, it's very obvious, and we have people who come up and comment about it, just like, okay, I can't wait until June next year when they come back again. So taste is the primary driver, I think, that people pick up on and say, hey, this is why I want to come back because this tastes so good. And
all right.
The price is competitive.
The price is, I mean, we know that there are some very high-priced restaurants across the country that pride themselves on having local produce, you know, fancy local mushrooms and fancy everything else. But they tend to be pricey, you know, fancy night-out places. What about the prices at your diner? Are they in line with what a typical diner would be, higher, lower?
No, we are pretty much right in line. Some items were about 5 to 10% higher. So on a $5 meal, we might be at $5.50. On other items, we're a little bit lower. I think our milkshakes right now, they're all organic, very fresh ice cream. They're probably the best deal because we're running a little bit below some of the national and regional chains like Friendly's and Applebee's and so forth.
Okay, Todd Murphy, pull back the curtain for us a little bit now. If I've got this right, you worked at one time for Starbucks. You worked to open a coffee franchise network at one point. You've got a national vision for diners like the Farmer's Diner that, if I read correctly, may have already or maybe soon attracting millions of dollars in investment. What's the big picture here? Where's this headed if everything goes your way?
Well, what we would like to do is replicate the model that we have here in Vermont. And what we've been talking about is the diner, which is the very public face, and there's a very easy buy-in for customers. You know, there's that visceral reaction of having really great hamburger. What makes the diner possible that people don't see is that we also own and operate a USDA-inspected meat processing facility, which has given us a tremendous advantage at being able to bring in foods from around that tight geographic circle. We have a delivery truck on the road. We have large capacity for refrigeration and freezer capacity, and we have the ability to bring in, particularly in terms of meat, product that's not been processed down, and it allows us to get some economies there by cutting out a lot of the middlemen.
So you've got your network of produce suppliers, even your own butcher, your own meat processing facility, and what's the – you're looking here for something national. How does this multiply? Does it mean you'll be shipping out of Barrie, Vermont, or you'll be trying to replicate this sort of network, local network in one community, then another? How's it work?
We want to replicate that that model. We call it a pod model, where there's a central processing facility for vegetables and meat that supplies out to the group of diners that surrounds it. You know, the biggest issue for the types of farmers that we're talking about, the kind of iconic American family farmer that's kept them from thriving, and actually, you know, we have been losing them at an unbelievable rate. The biggest reason for that is that the local infrastructure that used to support them is totally decimated. And we found that here, even in Vermont, which is very conscious of agricultural issues.
You mean there's no way for them to distribute locally very often, even if they want to? They've got to kind of feed into the national distribution chain?
Right. There's first just the processing issue. There's very little processing that's affordable and to appropriate scale. And then there's exclusion from the supermarkets and those kinds of outlets. And so we're left, like we are here in Vermont, we're left nationally trying to process and do value added, which costs a huge amount because the facilities aren't there. And then we really can't get into the markets we want to get into. So the biggest area where farmers who have been succeeding have succeeded is in direct marketing. What we want to do
farmers markets, that sort of thing.
Farmers markets, you know, freezer beef, you know, a farmer who raises great beef.
Mm-hmm.
We want to bring the farmer's diner with that central processing facility into other communities so that farmers can supply the diner initially with product, and that sets them up financially to be okay. And then it also gives them the opportunity to begin to compete in their local market with their own branded meat if they want, or with salsa, or with some of these other value-added products that really they can't compete with right now.
It's quite a picture. So you're talking about grabbing food back down to the local level. In this, of course, one of the most centralized, enormous industries that there is in the U.S. Todd Murphy, please stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation Bill McKibben. He joins us from Middlebury, Vermont. He's a resident scholar at Middlebury College, author of Enough, Staying Human in an Engineered Age, and he's written about your farmer's diner. Good evening and welcome, Bill McKibben.
It's good to be with you, Tom.
It's great to have you, Bill. So what's the significance of this diner sitting up in Barrie, Vermont, selling meat and eggs and milk and vegetables that have come from within a 60, 80-mile radius, Bill?
Well, look, if you were a realist, you would say the significance of it was a flash in the pan, you know, in a world that's seemingly dominated more each week by the Walmarts and the McDonald's, in a world where we talk constantly about globalization, it seems like a drop in the bucket. My guess is that it might be one of the first kind of outlier indications, though, of what comes next, of what's beginning to be a sort of small but growing reaction against that endless globalization. And it's no accident that you see it happening first with food, not just with Todd's Diner, but with things like the slow food movement in Europe. You know, the average bite of food that an American eats has traveled 1,500 miles from the farm before it reaches his lips.
Mm-hmm.
That's a long journey. It's a long journey with a lot of side effects, environmental side effects, enormous side effects for rural America, which has been steadily depopulated in the last 6 or 7 decades as we've moved to ever larger farms growing food ever more efficiently and cheaply. Some of those things, you know, we've come to think of as great virtues, efficiency and cheapness.
Mm-hmm.
But we're beginning to realize that maybe there can be way too much of a good thing.
So maybe this is the thin edge of the wedge up in Barrie, Vermont. Bill McKibben, Todd Murphy, stand by. We're going to come back in a few minutes and talk much more about this. It's fascinating. We're talking tonight about one man's answer to mad cow, bad salmon, and chickens with the flu. Todd Murphy, owner of the Farmer's Diner in Barrie, Vermont. You can join our conversation tonight. Have you had it with Frankenfood? With industrial long-distance processed meat, vegetables, and milk, is there a market niche for a national restaurant franchise that serves locally grown food? Are you ready for the anti-McDonald's? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about one man's answer to mad cow, bad salmon, and chickens with the flu. Todd Murphy, owner of the Farmer's Diner in Barrie, Vermont, wants Americans to eat locally grown food again, and that is a kind of, maybe, revolution in the making. You can join our conversation tonight. Do you want your food shiny and shrink-wrapped, or still with some local dirt in the leaves? Do all the stories of burdened environments and industrial agriculture make you long for the old days, the old ways, maybe a new way? Are mad cow, toxic salmon, and chickens with flu telling us something? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. John's calling from Watertown, Wisconsin. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. It's a pleasure to speak with you. I have a couple of things. First of all, I want to say that I admire the gentleman, I didn't catch his name, who is creating this restaurant.
Todd Murphy. Todd Murphy's the name.
Mr. Murphy. Well, congratulations, Mr. Murphy. I applaud you. And I appreciate this program very much because my wife and I, for a long time, she's been more of a vegetarian and organic eater before me, and I'm slowly converting. One of the challenges we have is that you can't find places to get this stuff in. It's hard even in grocery stores and at restaurants. It's almost entirely out of the question. And we live in rural Wisconsin, and it just kills me that you can't go to the grocery store and buy local produce. You look at things that are grown right here in Wisconsin, and on the grocery store shelves, they're coming from all over the country, California, Central America. I think this would help create local economies, like you said, circulating mm-hmm. the dollar. Mm-hmm. If we could create more of these restaurants, if you could take a national chain like this restaurant and use local goods at each one of those chains, I think it would just be an incredible phenomenon. And I, for one, would be thrilled to have one of these restaurants in our area.
Sounds like a ready customer, and that sounds like pretty much exactly Todd Murphy's dream. Todd, that is it, isn't it?
That is it. It is to build out a national chain where each group of diners is buying from within the local community. There are just a huge number of advantages to us as a business doing that, as well as to the local community.
Speak about those advantages.
Well, one thing we discovered here that was really surprising was how much the suppliers, the farmers and the local food producers, people who make raviolis and so forth, became salespeople for the diner wherever they went because they had a very vested interest in it, and it was also a point of pride. Additionally, what's happened over the last year is we've become kind of the go-to source for trying to find local foods. I receive inquiries constantly about where can we get fresh eggs, where can we get all grass-fed beef, things like that. So we've actually become a clearinghouse of information for customers to find local food. Like John's talking about the difficulty of finding that, and there's a lot of back road type deals that you have to know how to do. And we have set up that network, and we know where those people are. And even if we're not buying directly from them all the time, we send a lot of customers their way.
So, John, thanks for your call. It sounds like it's resonating just that way. Todd Murphy, I've got to ask you though. What really makes this work economically? I mean, you've got to build all these resources and find all these people locally. Does it add up? Could this really be replicated across the country?
Yes, I think it can. My wife and I, as you mentioned at the beginning, we did a multi-unit chain after we left Starbucks. That was in Atlanta and New York and L.A. So, a lot of geography to cover in between those three towns. And we spent a lot of time figuring out how to do the operation and then how to duplicate it so we could go into a new area.
But, all this makes me think of the Moosewood restaurant, Moosewood cookbook, and all. There was a whole genre of those books that have been out for years in restaurants, but they've tended to stay kind of local, funky, not muscling in next to Wendy's and McDonald's. Why would this effort be different?
Well, I'm not sure we're going to play in the Wendy's McDonald's game. We're going to be playing in the more the family dining, you come in and sit down game. And there's a lot of support in the community when the community understands that this is about people that they know or places that they drive by on their way to work. And there's an authenticity to that, as opposed to going into a restaurant that has fake antiques that were made in China a year ago. People get that there's integrity and authenticity to what we're doing, and they support that. That's been, you know, across the board in terms of the social, economic, and the political spectrum. We've had everybody from the Libertarian candidate for governor to the Republican and the Democrat in, because when it's about a local issue, right, Tip O'Neill's thing, they get it. It doesn't matter anymore what your affiliation is. It's local and it's your neighborhood, and that's what you care about.
Bill McKibben, you've written a lot about nature and abuse of nature. Take us down the list of how you see the cost of not going in this direction, the cost of the kind of food distribution and industrial agriculture that Americans are looking at now.
Sure. Right now, our food system is underwritten by a complete reliance on cheap fossil energy, which probably won't be viable all that far into the future. And even at the moment, exacts enormous cost in terms of things like emitting carbon into the atmosphere, draining underground aquifers. The basic point is we're down to under 2% of Americans actually farming. When you're farming on that scale, when there's that few people having to take care of that much land, the possibility of doing it in some kind of really responsible way is very small. And the pressures as food becomes an incredibly, maybe in some ways, the most industrialized part of our food chain to do it, of our economy, to do it cheaply, are so enormous. I mean, go look at how Tyson Chicken gets their food. In essence, they have serfs working for them, people raising 50 and 100,000 broilers in huge battery cages.
But, Bill, isn't that what underwrites the relatively low cost of food in American supermarkets?
Absolutely.
I mean, are you really imagining a kind of new Jeffersonian America with prosperous farmers all over the place? Wouldn't that mean much higher prices at the grocery store?
Well, the question, I mean, it's a very good question. And I think it goes to the very heart of all this. I mean, Americans do pay very low prices for food. They probably pay prices that are a little bit too low. And because of that, you know, we get this huge set of consequences. I said about Todd's place that, you know, one of the things that people were buying when they went there for dinner, and dinner really is good at the Farmer's Diner, was they were buying a story that went with their food. And I think that probably people will pay 5 or 10% more in order to get that story. The question for Todd is going to be whether or not he's able to make it work on a big scale for that, within that kind of margin. I think he can, because at the moment there are enormous, though food is incredibly cheap on the one hand, on the other hand, the middlemen are taking huge chunks out of that. I mean, farmers are getting pinched at every turn, and so if he can cut out some of those middlemen, maybe he'll be able to keep the costs more or less in line.
That may be the way. We'll look more closely at that. Let's get another call first. Vicki is calling from Newton, Massachusetts. Hi, Vicki, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to kind of take the conversation in a little bit of a different direction.
Mm-hmm.
It's a personal and professional interest, and for some reason I have heard about Mr. Murphy's restaurant diner before, and I hope it may just be NPR and all my resources because I listen very frequently.
He's getting a lot of ink lately. Bill McKibben wrote about him in Harper's Magazine. The New York Times has written about him, so you're not alone in that.
Oh, okay, so I'm on information overload, but I wanted to address the question of organizations that are financing businesses like this particular diner, and because I'm professionally involved in it, and I think for some reason I've got this connection in my mind that this diner was somehow financed by a group of organizations that are really trying to support businesses that are doing socially responsible, environmental, community-oriented types of activities, and I just wondered if he could address that issue.
Vicki, we had the same question, and I think we're nicely prepared to answer that. Thanks for your call. Let me invite into our conversation from Jericho, Vermont, Chuck Lacey. Chuck was former president of Ben & Jerry's, a big ice cream company, born in Vermont and prospered in Vermont. He's now president of the Bard Rock Fund. It's an investment group that supports sustainable agricultural initiatives. Good evening and welcome, Chuck Lacey.
Hi.
Hi. Thanks for joining us tonight, Chuck.
Sure.
So we read that when you first heard what Todd Murphy was proposing, you turned him down flat. Vicki, our caller, says somebody turned around here. I guess it was in part you and other investors. how are you looking this at this as a businessman, as a as an investor? What's the opportunity? What's the dynamic here?
Well, I was a real skeptic at first. You know, the diner right down the street from Todd just calls up Cisco or somebody like that, and
huge food supplier.
Yeah, they just get coleslaw and chicken cuts delivered, all portion control, and you know, Todd's got to go get the cabbage and make coleslaw.
It's a lot of work.
And then he's got to go get the chicken and somehow get some chicken breasts out of that chicken by going, you know, finding a slaughterhouse. And it's a lot more work. And in the beginning, I just wasn't sure that he could do it. But, you know, the more I thought about it and the more, you know, it's an incredibly powerful idea. And I just decided that, number one, it's too good an idea to pass up. I mean, this is how you break ground, is you take a risk. You do something that people think is impossible, but you make sure you're doing it with somebody good. And Todd works like a farmer. So I decided to give him a chance.
Well, let us pick this apart a little bit, Chuck Lacey, though. Your group, the Bard Rock Fund, is described as a group supporting sustainable agriculture. Are you in this for philanthropic reasons or to turn a venture capital-style profit?
I want to make an honest profit. You know, I think one of the problems in the food industry is people are, you know, Monsanto and some of these companies are working on making a dishonest profit. If I can just make a decent return and improve the quality of life and improve life for farmers and agriculture, and make a decent return so I can just keep on going, then I'll be happy.
Chuck Lacey, stick with us. We want to get the big picture that you see here. But Todd Murphy, let me ask you first. Farmer's Diner, as I understand, raised about $250,000 and broke even in its first year. Have I got that right?
Well, in part. We raised – there's two operations. There's the slaughterhouse and there's the diner. So we've raised a little over $500,000. And in our first year, we've had months of break even. We've also had – to figure out how to deal with months like the one we're in now where it doesn't get above zero during lunchtime. And that's a process that takes about 2 years to get through. This January, we are again at break even, which is great for us in the winter. So, you know, financially, that's where we are. One of the things we had to do with a 60-seat restaurant is convince guys like Chuck that we could actually execute on this.
Mm-hmm.
The financials for a 60-seat restaurant are really tough, and it's not at all what we would envision going forward. We would like to do larger restaurants of about 150 seats, the type of restaurants you see when you look at other family dining establishments like TGI Fridays or Applebee's, kind of their mid-sized restaurant footprint.
Mm. So Chuck, I'm sure Todd could do this, but I wonder if you'd walk us through, take this out to a national scale then. As an investor, as someone, I think you were at Ben & Jerry's as they went from $50 million in sales to $150 million in sales. You know how to scale things. How do you see, give us the business case, the business model for Farmer's Diner scaling across the country? How's it work?
Well, I think the first thing is it's a very powerful idea that resonates with people. I mean, number one is always the product in any business like this, and people have a hunger for the food. I mean, if you've ever tasted a fresh egg, you know what I'm talking about. And I think Todd can bring people into restaurants. One of the keys, as Todd said, is that we need to have enough restaurants in a local area to support a commissary so that we can process the food. We can also sell food out of the commissary to restaurants and also to stores, but to be the center of local agriculture. And one of the things that the restaurants that he'll be competing with spend a tremendous amount of money on advertising. Chili's and Olive Garden. I mean, we've all, you know, when you hear your family, you've all seen the Olive Garden
sure.
ad a million times.
Sure.
And that's because they don't have as powerful an idea as Todd does.
But so part of the idea with any franchise is some expectation of consistency. If you're thinking of Farmer's Diners across the country, you're going to have the signage that we recognize, presumably, and the layout that one way or another we recognize. But Todd, with different agriculture in every region, aren't you going to have different food in every restaurant?
Yes, and no. It goes back to that question. If we all got together and talked about what a diner menu would look like, we would come up with about 80% of it and we would agree on it. And then what you start to do, and I describe this as a company that would be vertically integrated but decentralized. We would have in every pod of diners, there would be a chef who would be making the decision about what specials are and what the local cuisine would be. So in Vermont, we have maple cream pie. If we were in Louisiana, you know, we'd have pecan pie. And so those are local calls that can be made locally. But in Louisiana, you still have hamburgers and you still have hash. You may have gumbo instead of beef stew, but mm-hmm. you know, those are differences that in a diner we can easily get away with.
Adam's calling from Boston. Hi, Adam. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Good to have you.
Yeah, that's actually the question I was just going to ask, which is about consistency within a brand. You know, if I go to McDonald's in Albuquerque, I'm going to get the same hamburger that I get here in Boston, which I think is one of the main things that made, you know, McDonald's so successful. People traveling know what they're going to get when they go into a restaurant.
So can you imagine, Adam, a different kind of expectation of consistency, that you wouldn't get exactly the same burger, but the consistency would be that it was locally grown? Is that compelling to you?
I'm totally in favor of the idea, and I think it's a fabulous idea. I'm just wondering if Todd sees that as an issue, the consistency within a brand.
Todd, how do you think about it?
Well, I think on the basics, we will be consistent. We've already written the book for how you do Farmer's Diner hash and what the standards are for making meatloaf. And those are just basic standard recipes that you can easily duplicate anywhere. And in terms of production, which is the other side of flavor, production on the farm, we have some very basic standards. And as we work with farmers, we're working more and more to bring farmers up to a higher standard in terms of their production. Beef, for example, we are working to go to all grass-fed beef. Now, there's a whole host of issues that you need to educate farmers on in order to do that, and we're in that process. But on the basics on the menu, it would be very easy to be consistent. We have the recipes, and you have people in each pod who are responsible for the quality assurance that recipes are being followed. And then you get the local flavor that you can run as specials, that reflect the local culture.
Adam, does that sound compelling enough to you, consistent enough to bring you in?
Sure enough.
Okay, thanks for your call. Chuck Lacey, you're the investor here. What's the big picture? What's the upside potential, as they say?
Well, I just want to add one thing to the last point, is that one of the resources that Todd's developing is the expertise to do this.
Which has been largely lost,
and that's something that he will have in his organization. Another thing he's going to have is he's going to have good people working for him. The restaurant industry is very, very hard to find good people.
Why should his be better?
Because people will want to be part of people who will be passionate about what he's trying to accomplish. I mean, just some of the people who are calling in tonight. I mean,
yeah, we can hear it.
I think, you know, that was one of the keys to Ben & Jerry's. We had fabulous people because they wanted to work there.
Chuck Lacey, we've got to take a break, but please stay with us. Bill McKibben, Todd Murphy, stand by. We're talking tonight about one man's answer to mad cow, bad salmon, and chickens with the flu. Todd Murphy, owner of the Farmer's Diner. He wants to take local and more organic than most food national, maybe franchise style. What do you think? Would you pull over for a homegrown meal? Or are you hooked on Chilean grapes, strawberries from Ecuador, 75-cent hamburgers? We're at 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Todd Murphy, owner of the Farmer's Diner in Barrie, Vermont. He wants Americans to eat locally grown food again, and that just may be a revolution in the making. You can join our conversation tonight. Is there a market niche for a national restaurant franchise that serves locally grown food? Are you ready for the anti-McDonald's? And do you want your food shiny and shrink-wrapped or still with some local dirt in the leaves? Be honest about that question. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're also joined tonight by Bill McKibben. He is the author of Enough, Staying Human in an Engineered Age and The End of Nature. He's written about Todd Murphy's restaurant up in Barrie, Vermont, and its national implications. And we're joined from Jericho, Vermont, by Chuck Lacey. He's former president of Ben & Jerry's Ice Cream. He's now president of the Bard Rock Fund. They invest in sustainable agriculture initiatives. You can join us as well tonight. Lauren's on the line from Brighton, Massachusetts. Hi, Lauren. You're on the air.
Hi. I was wondering how you deal with seasonality and if there are certain items that you don't serve during the winter For instance, like if you, you know, like for the strawberries, if you only have those, you know, in June when they're local, as a way of, you know, keeping this, you know, the quality of your food as high as possible and educating consumers about, you know, seasonal eating seasonally.
Todd Murphy, how about it?
Sure. That's a big issue. And when we started the first year we were open, we purchased about 60%. We spent about 60 cents out of every dollar locally. And over the 18 months since then, we're just north of 70 cents out of every dollar locally. Just today, we brought in onions from a local farmer, and he obviously harvested those back in October when he could still dig them out of the ground. And he was delivering those today. So over the 18 months, we've slowly been figuring out how to bring in more product, what kind of product is stable, what do we have for storage. On strawberries, in all likelihood, those would always be a seasonality type of product. We'd bring them in June and July, and that would be it. But one of the things we want to do in our vegetable processing commissary is have the ability to put some of these products into a restaurant-ready format. And strawberries are an example where they normally come in a form called individually quick frozen. Mm. You know, you can buy them in the supermarket in a bag like that. There are products that we'd like to do that with so that we could still have locally raised vegetables in the middle of January.
In other words, harvest in the summer, do the freeze, and have
right.
them there in February.
Right, and there are some vegetables we would like to do that with, but we also go seasonal. We have squash and that summer squash in the summer, and then we go to the winter squash that keep, and we do that with potatoes and some of the other vegetables that we'll keep over time. But there are some of those things that we would like to have.
But what about your customers on this front? I mean, we read that, you know, the vegetable of the day these days in Barrie, Vermont at the Farmer's Diner is beets. And it's the beets today and it's beets tomorrow and it's beets the next day because you've got root vegetables there this time of year that you can keep. I mean, can you really keep up with the American appetite that's been trained to want anything growing anywhere in the world right now?
Well, and this is a spot where right now we are going to our local produce guy and buying what we can buy to kind of vary that up. But we've also so we've had kale and we've had carrots and the dreaded frozen corn when we get a run on the diner because something's happening down at the Opera House and we didn't know about it. But we've also been working with farmers who have greenhouse operations here who have not previously kept them going in January and February. And because we represent a pretty good market for them, particularly over the next 2 years as we expand up here, now they're considering looking at some other ways of doing winter growing, digging deeper greenhouses, copying some great examples that exist in the organic farming world here in New England.
Lauren, how's it sound? Are you ready to give up your Chilean winter grapes?
Oh, yeah, I gave it up a while ago. But I was also wondering, like, what percentage, do you have a portion of your menu that is seasonal that, you know, where you, if you're one, you're 80, you know, like you said, 80% of the diner food people would all agree on, you have that section, and then you have another section, which is, like, very, very seasonal, very unique.
And, Todd, if I could expand on that, how much is seasonal, how much is organic, and how much is finally local?
Well, the local is the 70 cents out of every dollar.
So if I want orange juice, that's not going to be local.
No.
But you're going to have it.
I'm going to have it, and when we have two more stores up here, we're probably going to buy from a dairy cooperative out of the Midwest that brings in organic orange juice. So that would be, you know, kind of nice for people, and that would support their efforts. But in terms of seasonal, the menu does go seasonal in terms of specials. Like we have lamb right now because the lamb has just become available for us, and we are doing some of the root vegetables right now because that's what we have. And so we see the seasonality come and go through specials. We do a tomato salad in the summer that's fantastic, and it's about $3. And it's the same grower who was growing tomatoes for Alice Waters out at Chez Panisse. So,
and how about organic? What percentage of your food is actually organic?
Almost all the dairy is organic, and beef can be at times organic depending on who picking it up from, and pork, when we're buying local pork, frequently is organic. We have never really stressed the organic except on the dairy and if it's been a special. When we're buying vegetables and we know that the farm is certified organic, then we put that up on the board.
Lauren, thanks for your call. Bill McKibben, I want to turn to you and just ask, how big a difference could something like this make if it works, if it takes off, if it were to be replicated across the country?
Well, here's the thing. I mean, and it goes right to this actually interesting question of organic and local. You know, local is going to be, with any luck, the new organic. And that's important because it's...
Now, what do you mean by that? Local instead of organic?
What I mean is, well, you know, organic for a long time has been the sort of proxy that you use when you say, I want to support my local farm, the, you know, small farmer, the whatever. That isn't what it really is anymore. The last few years, it too has become co-opted into big business. The average bite of organic food in this country at your supermarket now travels farther than the average bite of conventional food. Mm-hmm. Del Monte is about, I think, now the biggest organic grower in the country. And so you get almost all the same issues except pesticides that you do with conventional food.
And you're talking about, well, of course, the cost of transporting it and the loss to the local economy.
Yeah, and, you know, the sort of destruction of the rural farm economy and all of that. Local is the one thing that you can't co-opt because of its very nature. If it has to come from within 50 miles of the farm or whatever it is that you've set as your limit, then there's no way to scale it up to a huge level. What Todd is doing is walking this very fine and interesting line between getting just big enough, just enough economy of scale in order to survive. So he goes 50 miles outside mm-hmm. his door and tries to support three or four diners from one pod, but without getting big in the way that Denny's or Applebee's or whatever gets big, where it's just frozen crap on a truck arriving, you know, and being slid into some microwave.
Let's get one more call if we can. Wynn's calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Wynn, you're on the air.
Hello. I had a question having to do with his expansion strategy and how to move from the one diner on up to others, and how to find out, you know, if you have places that locally don't produce foods that are of the diner menu, how you would, you know, deal with that.
How to deal with that. Yeah, Todd Murphy.
Okay, so what we're doing right now over the next 18 months is we're really putting together the playbook on how to go out and duplicate ourselves into another area. One of the things that's happened with the New York Times and the Harper's articles, we've had a number of people calling us and, you know, sending in, here is a list of 30 growers around Madison that you need to talk to when you come to Madison.
Mm-hmm.
So finding growers for a number of items is turned out to be much easier than I had expected. The other thing is I fully expect that when we open a pod of diners that we will outstrip supply fairly quickly. We've done that in Vermont with just this one diner and trying to find pork. And that's fantastic. I mean, that's really the vision of this thing is not to be in the restaurant business. It's to revive rural economies. And so this past year, I've had to help start two people in farming on pork farming. One was a young boy who was thinking about getting into farming, and this was a great opportunity. And another was kind of the new American farmer, somebody who left their career in Philadelphia and came to Vermont to farm, and they wanted to know, what do you do? We've never farmed before, and pork is a great place to start. So I expect that we're going to outstrip the supply, and we create such a demand, and we're going to have to educate and recruit and find farmers. And that's the real fun of this whole project.
That's quite a picture. Chuck Lacey, you're the investor here. Despite your special writ, you're the hard-nosed guy. Is this scalable? Is the huge agribusiness industry in the United States, as it's structured today, vulnerable to a challenge like this from below, from local?
Absolutely. I think people are ready for this. I think they've had enough. Many people have just had enough of living with the current agricultural system. And I think they're ready to speak out, and I think they're going to find their way to farmers' diners. And, we'll see. We'll see if we can build them fast enough.
And a little Ben and Jerry's style cachet that may travel with this?
The cachet comes from a powerful idea. And this is potentially as significant as McDonald's was, 40 years ago.
That's pretty big. Todd Murphy, we just have a few seconds left. If it went like gangbusters, in what year might 10% of Americans eat locally owned food, locally grown?
If it went like gangbusters, 10% of Americans would eat locally grown food within a decade, and it wouldn't all be at the farmer's diner.
Well, it's quite a picture. We wish you luck with it. It's an inspiring idea. Thanks a lot for being with us.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
Todd Murphy, founder of the Farmer's Diner in Barrie, Vermont. Look for it 1 year soon, maybe in your neighborhood. Bill McKibben, thanks for being with us tonight.
Oh, my pleasure.
Great having you again. And Chuck Lacey in Jericho, Vermont, thanks for being on.
Thanks.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, a newly released tape reveals the chaos on American Airlines Flight 11 on 9/11. This is On Point. More details of the harrowing events of September 11, 2001 were released yesterday by the bipartisan commission investigating the attacks. The commission has concluded that some of the 9/11 hijackers may have used mace and high-strength metal utility knives rather than more easily concealed box cutters on at least some of the flights. It also concluded that 9 of the 19 hijackers had been flagged by the FAA's security system to be more thoroughly screened because they had paid cash or had purchased a one-way ticket, but the 9 were ultimately allowed to board. At a hearing yesterday, the commission released tape of a dramatic phone call made by Betty Ong, a flight attendant on American Airlines Flight 11, the first jet to ram into New York's World Trade Center. In this excerpt, a remarkably calm Betty Ong describes the chaos and confusion on board the plane after the hijacking to American Airlines operations specialist on the ground.
Number 3 in the back, the cockpit's not answering. Somebody's stabbed in business class. And I think there's mates that we can't breathe. I don't know. I think we're getting hijacked.
Which flight are you on?
Flight 12.
Ma'am, what seat are you in?
We just left Boston. We're up in the air. We're supposed to go to L.A., and the cockpit's not answering their phone.
Okay, but what seat are you sitting in? What's the number of your seat?
Okay, I'm in my jump seat right now.
Okay.
At 3R.
What is your name?
Okay, my name is Betty Ong. I'm number 3 on flight 11.
Okay.
And the cockpit is not answering their phone. And there's somebody stabbed in business class. And we can't breathe in business class. Somebody's got mace or something.
Can you describe the person that you said someone is what in business class?
I'm sitting in the back. Somebody's coming back from business. If you can hold on for 1 second, sure. They're coming back. Our number 1 is got stabbed. Our purser is stabbed. Nobody knows who stabbed who, and we can't even get up to business class right now because nobody can breathe. Our number 1 is stabbed right now.
Okay.
And our number 5, our first class passengers, our first class galley flight attendant and our purser has been stabbed. And we can't get the cockpit. The door won't open.
At this point,
this is operations. What flight number are we talking about?
Flight 12.
Flight 12. Okay, I'm going on flight 11 right now. This is flight 11.
It's flight 11. I'm sorry, Nitty.
Boston to Los Angeles.
Yes.
Our number 1 has been stabbed, and our 5 has been stabbed. Can anybody get up to the cockpit? We can't even get into the cockpit. We don't know who's up there.
A phone conversation between Betty Ong, a flight attendant on American Airlines Flight 11, and one of American's operations specialists on the ground during the hijacking on September 11, 2001. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.